Good morning. He doesn't hear you. Literally, certain things fall on deaf ears.
No comment.
Just to mention one thing, I had a problem in my in shul that I had to ask a shaila. I mentioned to you that there was a somebody came to daven by us, and when I saw, first of all, he was a tinkle, a very nice boy, and I, you know, we've had some before come in who weren't Jewish, but this one I saw when he came with a sitter that had looked very used. I asked him if he was a Jew, and he said yes. And I said, whose sitter was it? He said, his grandfather. I wasn't sure at that point if it was a paternal or maternal, but it turned out to be his maternal grandfather. In fact, his grandfather has a supermarket on the Upper West Side, that a kosher place, and it was his father who's not Jewish. But he davened by us on Shabbos, and he comes regularly, and then he started going out with a Jewish girl also, but he went to another shul, and it got me a little annoyed, because I was told that the rabbi from the shul on Ralph Avenue asked him to leave the shul, because he was concerned that he just didn't believe that he was Jewish and didn't want him in the shul. So I called him, but anyhow, I wanted to find out what his situation was, because I asked him if he had a bris milah. He didn't officially have a bris milah, but he did have a circumcision by a doctor, and I asked him who the doctor was. He said it was a Jewish doctor, and he's only 29 years old, so the doctor is still in practice, and he's on Ocean Parkway all the way down, and the doctor said that he knew he was giving a bris to a Jewish baby, but he didn't have a tavastam bris. So I wanted to find out, just to be clear, because the other rabbi was giving me a hard time. So I asked Aryeh to call Rabbi. I figured it better than me, I'll ask him to ask Rav David Cohen. I figured that would put everything to rest. And so yesterday I stopped off at my nephew's house to get something, and he said right away, Rav David said, no problem, give him an aliyah. He said, no problem, just you can go ahead and give him an aliyah. Just to be pointed at, and the problem was, I was just concerned that he didn't have a tavas dam bris. I mean, he didn't have an official bris the way one would be necessary, but his reaction was just like this. He said, of course, no problem. I mean, that was his reaction. He showed me, that's what he said. Oh, bang, of course, no problem. So, obviously, it was no problem. And, in fact, just discussing it is funny, because your reaction and a few people that I talked to who, say, know certain halachas, certainly, their reaction was the same thing. The first line is, all right, so you can't eat the Korban Pesach. It was exactly the same line that a few people gave me the first thing. It was very funny. It was exactly the same line that the Korban Pesach. I just wanted to give you a Maaseh Shehayah now, just to elucidate something, because it becomes a bigger and bigger problem as we grow. And I said to him, of course, in his shul, he has a shul that was until now, I mean, he wasn't the rabbi there, but that shul, Hillel, was a conservative shul till very recently, and it's only in the last few years that it became a frum shul. The thing is that still most of the minyan that is there is a lot of the old members who are from the conservative shul. And the thing is, so I said, do you know for a fact that people in your shul, what kind of a bris that they had? You're being malshin this person. What about he says, oh, I don't know, but I said, but what was your rationale for telling him to leave and not come back? Because not only did he come on Shabbos, what I found out, since my shul no longer had a daily minyan, he was going to shul every morning, not in the morning, I don't think, But for Mincha Maariv every day, he came to shul, and he's been going and trying. He doesn't read Hebrew hardly at all, but he's trying to teach himself and to learn. And it's very commendable, and I think it's tremendous. So my point is, there's a reawakening in a lot of places, because some shuls have what they call, you know, you would call a black hat shul. In my shul has the black without the hat. So a few of them. I have, and they're Jewish. And I have now one lady who was very makbid about, you know, we once asked her, a lady came to shul, this is many years ago, from a different shul, and when we were having Shalosh Shudos, and she was there for Mincha Maariv, she sat there, and then somebody motioned her to come, and she was sitting in the women's section there, and they said, why don't you come and sit by the table with us over there? She looked at like we're from outer space. She said she wouldn't sit at the table with a man. You don't do those things. And so she has a problem with one of her daughters, but they have a grandson. She brings him to shul, and he's about to turn 12. And he goes to yeshiva. He wears his tzitzis out, and he comes to shul on Shabbos. He has a problem davening, but she was talking to me about a year from now that he's going to get bar mitzvah. But she's very Jewish, and she has a kosher home, and she only shops in, you know, we don't realize about certain people the level of Yiddishkeit that they do have, and it was carried down, and how far back. This goes back a long way. Where a lot of these people came from, some of them were from either from mixed marriages or from wherever it is. You know, you don't know where it begins. But nevertheless, the reason I mentioned this as well is we get to, you know, we're learning now Parshas Vayechi, and a lot of it has to do with things we learned in Hosea and Yoel and Amos. We're doing all these things, and there's a tie-in because there was Jews that were all over the place in the world, and they, I don't know what it was looked upon, especially when we get to Moshe Rabbeinu, and the Abarbanel makes a very interesting point when it says, Ki Yishar Kushis Lokach, and we discuss where Tzipora came, you know, what her background was. We don't really think of her as, you know, a Kushis, what we translate as dark-skinned person. And the Abarbanel makes a very tremendous, I mean, a definitive statement that she is. And he says that Moshe seemed to be all his life because being married to Tzipora was causing a problem to him in terms of he realized people were talking and he was a little bit, you know, uneasy about the situation. You know, you're trying to be the leader of Klal Yisrael and somehow you hear an undercurrent of conversation. And, you know, when it says, Vatadaber Miriam Va'arom B'Moshe, Ki Yishar Kushis Lokach, so he says this was Miriam and Aaron talking, it's in quotes, and he says, Ki Yishar Kushis Lokach, he said, what did he think? He married her when she was dark 20 years ago. She's still... Yeah, she didn't change. So what does he expect, you know, but... That's just the sidelight. I just wanted to mention that before. That had nothing to do with what I was going to say today. I didn't have a lot of time over here, but I think a lot of... Yeah, what do you want to say? Go ahead.
They had 2 weeks ago, there was a pagua, a pregnant woman was shot in a drive-by.
Yeah.
And they operated on the child who didn't survive. In 2 to 4 days, the child died. And they gave the child a name at the bris, at the kavura. They made a bris to give him a name.
Listen, there's... Okay.
So what if a guy doesn't have a bris, what is the problem? I don't understand what...
No, but there are people who... My point is, there are people who are making decisions
who don't really...
I never ask, you know, if I have a... I know in my mind what my reaction is, my immediate reaction, but I don't think of myself as any kind of a posek, and so therefore I'm always going to ask when I want to be sure, especially if I'm going to have to make decisions based on it. I want to hear from somebody who I'm not going to have to, no one's going to second guess. Yeah.
Does Rabbi jump the gun?
I gave him I really let him have it. Because he, at the very least, let him stay there. Why ask him to leave? But he's an Eretz Yisrael Dika person.
So he has no experience of...
Yeah, whatever it is, he's young. And he's trying to show that he's very frum, maybe, or whatever it is, I don't know. I don't know. You don't know what people think. He said that his excuse was that he just didn't think that he was really Jewish. Ah, another good point, which I said, and if so, because I've had people in the shul who came in, and there were two boys who came, not boys, but two, they were young men who came in, and we really thought they were Jewish, and they came in and they took a talus off the rack and put it on the way you put on a talus and sat down. They were very educated people, and the gabbai, I didn't know any. I thought maybe he had spoken to them before, and he asked them, you know, if they wanted an aliyah, and they went. But as it turned out, at the Kiddush, they came down to Kiddush, and while we were talking to them at Kiddush, they were Catholic. And he was, they were from England, and they were doing, they were going around, they had a list of places to visit while they were in the United States. They were going to visit various religions and see how they operate, because they were going to school in England to, you know, he said Bobby Jones University, so I thought he was going to golf school. But in England, Bobby Jones University is a Catholic school where you learn to be a priest. And that was what I didn't understand when he said he was going to Bobby Jones University. I thought, yeah, there's a school, you know, for golf pros. But nevertheless, that's what my first reaction was. He said, no, this is a place where they, you know, you go, you get ordained and things like that. And he wanted to see a shul in operation. What? So I didn't know where he got, and he just, they wandered in one Shabbos, that was shul, and they had a nice time, you know, they saw, they had a nice chillant, and they
did
ate.
Did he cross himself?
What? No. They very respectful. They came in, they put on a yarmulke, and they put on a talis. They knew how to put on a talis. That was like, so they didn't just throw it on like you have a shul. I had one person in my shul where I saw that he was, I was bringing him around, and I went to Eichler's and I bought him a real talis and a talis bag with his name on it. And I gave it to him. He was very moved and he put it on. And then he came over to me after davening. He says, "This is very uncomfortable. I can't wear it anymore. If you don't mind," he just went to put on one of those small shawl talisim to put it on and continue to wear that. So, you know, you never know where things are going. But nevertheless, you have experiences. These are your experiences. But one of the reasons it occurred to me all these things is we see over here, I mentioned yesterday about a lot of the parasha has to do with the ascension of Yehuda to the leadership role. Yehuda's ascension to the leadership role is a growth process, obviously. Because initially, it's still Reuven, still the brother sticking up for Reuven, because the whole idea behind Mechiras Yosef was that Yosef was usurping the power. Rabbi Alpert makes, I was reading in the back, he has Hashmatis on the Parsha, and he says that, you know, the brothers had a certain level of Ruach HaKodesh. Also, that there would be 12 Shvatim in Eretz among the brothers, and they didn't see any particular leadership role, that they would just be 12 Shvatim, and this is the way they would be. And when Yosef gave forth his dreams, when Yosef came and was telling them all about it, suddenly they saw that one person is going to try to rule over them. And this was, as opposed to a united, you know, he saw them making a united federal law as opposed to states' rights, that each Shevet would be its own individual thing, and they felt very comfortable with that. Reuven and Shimon and Levi, each one would be their own tribe leading a section of Klal Yisrael, and now Reuven was coming to take away, not just usurp the Bechorah, but use the Bechorah as a means to rule them, not necessarily to be the Bechor. He didn't say, but suddenly, and part of the reason, he doesn't say this, but the Abarbanel makes a point of saying, when Yosef goes ahead and tells his brothers, and many Mepharshim deal with it as well, is that I understand when Yosef says, when he reveals himself, and he says, Al tergizu badorach. What is that all about, Al tergizu? Because he knows what's going to happen now. A lot of I told you so's. That this Reuven said this, Vayomer Aleihem Reuven Al Tishpachu Dam, Yehuda said Ma Betza, and they're all going through the motion of recriminations of what they did, and they try to kill him and various things, and it was they're going to fight. He says, Al Tergezu Badarach, I know what's going to happen on your way home. You're going to have arguments, you're going to have discussions and blaming and placing this and saying, it's your fault, no, it's your fault, because they realize they don't know what the future holds for them at this point. And Yosef says, this is the spin we're going to say. Just don't have to give them the backstory. You just tell them, Vayisimenu liov lefaro, liodon l'chol beso, moshel b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. You got it. It's an interesting point the Abarbanel points out. It's all three lashons of Sarara are in this one pasuk. Vayisimenu liov lefaro, Paro has made me, treating me like his father, uli adon l'chol beso, and a leader. In other words, adon is somebody who you look to and you are happy with him as your leader. Umoshel b'chol ashalo, and Moshel is a ruler, but with a heavy hand. And the point is that Yosef was trying to say, don't think I'm ruling them with a heavy hand. They love me here. They really like me. And it's safe to, right? I know, but that's his lashon. That's the lashon that he uses. They really like me here, and you could don't be afraid, because what's the reaction? Yeah, maybe you're the ruler, but when we come down, if they have it in for you, and Paro understands all of this. So what is when Yosef is interpreting the dreams and he gives Paro all this advice? What is the first thing that Paro does after his first decision, after he appoints Yosef? He does the most clever thing you could do, which is what?
Marry him.
What?
Marry him off.
To who? Because everybody is, even the Sarah Mashka is saying, Vishami Tanu Nar, Evet, Ivri. So the Abarbanel wants to make a point in saying that he's not trying to belittle Yosef. He's saying, don't think that he's an Egyptian and he knows our culture and he goes around with people. He's a young fella. He has no life experience. Eved, he's a slave, so he doesn't know how the upper crust live. Ivri. He wouldn't, even if he were a free Egyptian, he is a Jew. He's a foreigner. So there's no way he could know any way to interpret the dream this way, the way he did. He would not know any way. There are some that say they were just trying to hedge their bets by saying what? That, listen, it's not my fault. I mean, I'm just telling you, this is a little pipsqueak over here. Anar, Eved Ivri, and he was lucky maybe this time, but I don't know what he's going to say later. Give him a shot, it's worth it. But the point is, it's interesting the way he couches the phrases, but Yosef now over here is explaining to him, and what is the reaction? All the other advisors have been trying to advise Paro, give their interpretation, and none of them were acceptable. And then this person comes along and gives an interpretation, and there's another tremendous amount of jealousy, and there's murmurings amongst these people, and maybe on some level they want to get rid of Yosef. Whatever it is, they'll conspire. So Paro knows one thing. He's fully aware of politics, because this went on with the whole thing. Paro, what was the whole idea? What was the whole process over here of why he was so, you know, the fact that he would want to kill the wine steward and kill the, again, the Abarbanel points this out. What was the state of mind in Egypt that Paro, did anybody ask, what was Paro thinking so he got a piece of bread? You go into a restaurant and, you know, they give you something that is not good, you give it back and you say, listen, you know, I know you didn't mean it, but I got a fly in the soup. I got something is wrong. You don't say, you don't call up and say, I want this man put to death.
Is that any different than Pesachim did to Achashverosh and Mordechai?
Well, yeah, and I'll tell you why. Because at this point in time, he points out and he goes into historical references about the time frame over here. And there were many plots to kill. Well, yes, in some ways the same. There was an undercurrent of people attempting the life, you know, attempts on his life. And so he was very vigilant and very sensitive to things that were going on in the kingdom. There were murmurings of usurping the throne. And this is what was different in Egypt as opposed to other nations, which is what? The son of the Pharaoh did not. And if you go through history, the sons of the Pharaoh were never the next Pharaoh. The next Pharaoh was always, it was out of the family, it was whoever ascended the throne, whoever got rose to power, however it happened. In Rome was the same thing. But basically, Egypt was, and it had been invaded. The Hittites had ruled Egypt for 200 years. They had come down from the north, and they were very suspicious of all foreigners who were maybe coming to usurp the throne. And Paro was looking over his shoulder. And he thought possibly this was another attempt on his life, or it was, you know, they were tempting. What caused this feeling over here at this point in time? And he says, very simple. The ascension of Yosef, that when Yosef was in Beis Potiphar, and he had gotten all this power, people were saying, did you hear? You know, we have a class system. Nobody arises from the level, you know, you're a downtrodden little boy, you're a foreigner, and all of a sudden, it's Nar Eved Ivri. Look how far he's come. He's really risen up the ladder very fast. He was able to crack the caste system. There is a movement on the hoi polloi, the common folk, the lowlifes that are in society are beginning to, this was fomenting rebellion that the lower class was trying to usurp power from the upper class. Because here was a young fella cracking the barrier, class barrier. And this became a major concern. But Paro is no fool, and he sees it. How is he going to protect himself and protect Yosef as well? Because he realizes he needs Yosef. He marries him off to one of the most powerful people in the kingdom, becomes Yosef's father-in-law. So Potipharah now becomes Yosef's big ally. And Potipharah is very influential. Of course, he's Kohen. He is a very important person. So he runs interference for Yosef and tells his people, leave this person alone. And that's a very interesting way to look at it. But Paro is showing his political mettle over here. And this is how the scenario works out. What I started off saying over here is we're watching the ascension of Yehuda here. We watch him, but to reach that point, what gives Yehuda the koyach to do what he did and to reach the level of from somebody who says, ma betza kina roge sochinu, ma narviach, as they use the lashon, what are we going to get out? At least make something of the deal over here. And to be the person to rise to the occasion to say, onochi ervenu miyodit vakshenu, v'chotosi liyavi kol ayomim, what makes that person? You have to, you know, you need to hit rock bottom before you realize and to start to rise up. He has been the leader amongst his brothers for how long? Not very. Yehuda did not try to reach the pinnacle. He respected Reuven as the Bechor too. And Reuven was their leader, basically. He was the oldest. Yehuda might have been the biggest, the most imposing physical figure, and maybe he was the strongest of all his brothers, certainly. But nevertheless, he wasn't the de facto leader of the organization, so to speak. But he learned from his lessons. He, after the Maisa, after what he did, he internalized, and it was a growth process, but not yet. He didn't hit rock bottom. So the Chumash has to tell us, Vayered Yehuda me'esechav. And he literally hit a clinical depression over here, because he realized when the brothers listened to him, what he began to think about, he goes to bed at night and he's thinking to himself, we're not talking about ordinary people. And they think to themselves, I made a suggestion, Reuven made one, you know, suggestion. Yehuda overrode that suggestion from Shimon or Levi, and they listened to him, and he's thinking to himself, they listened to me. I could have done so much more. I could have affected a lot more. And he's beginning to tell himself, he's realizing, and he becomes depressed. And Vayered Yehuda me'esachav. So the Torah is telling us, like the Mepharshim say, what does it mean, Vayered Yehuda? Why does the Torah interrupt the whole story now with Vayered Yehuda me'esachav? So of course, the Mepharshim basically in the Gemara, I guess, mentions the same thing, is, you know, the refuah before the Makkah. God wants to let us know that he's always watching over Meitzitz Men Arachakim before we go down to Golis Mitzrayim, Mashiach is going to be born. But of course, that starts way before with Lot and his daughters, and it goes way back. Yes?
Isn't there an indication within the incident with Tamar about Yehuda that he already was separate? He already went on his own.
But why Vayered Yehuda me'esechav? Why is he giving us that whole story? What is the reason for the Chumash? There is everything that the more you read the Chumash, what it's important to learn to do, and it's very hard if you want to think clearly as some of the Mepharshim, what they did. I mean, why does the Ramban think what he thinks? Didn't he read Rashi and know what it means? He didn't read Rashi, maybe, because that clouds your perspective. What are you going to do if you want to learn to think? I mean, all the Rebbeim that I had that had an effect on me, you know, thinking of the certain things, they all made one thing very clear. And I mentioned, certain Rebbeim in my life, and they all had one perspective. When they would ask me something, and they would say, you remember Rabbi Bornstein, or Rabbi Thing, they always made a point of saying to me, when they would say to me, so tell me, what do you think? And I would say, well, so-and-so says this. He said, I don't care. I don't care. I quoted the line many times. So I said to Rabbi Bornstein that time, well, the Rashba says, he says, who cares what the Rashba says? And that's what he said. I know the Rashba. We could all read the Rashba. I'm spending time with you now? Because I want to know what you think. And when I went to take my Bechina Chavetz Chaim, he just looked around, flipped the Gemara off the shelf, let it flop down on the table, whatever page it's open to. Unfortunately, I'd never seen the Gemara before in my life at 18 years old. It opened up to Bal Yachbar in Baba Basra, and he said, he pointed to a spot on the page, and he said, make a laning, I'll be back in an hour. And we'll talk about it. But the point is, I want to hear how your mind works. put everything, we grow up, we went to yeshiva all these years, just clear your head. Don't think that Rashi has, you know, forget about whatever you learned. Literally. Read the pasuk, what does it say to you? And that is how the Ramban worked, that's how the Ramban worked, that's how all these things is. I mean, they had their own. You think that he thinks that Rashi doesn't know what he's talking about? But when Rabbi Levine says many times, you know, you express something, and he doesn't say, you know, hey, you don't know what you're talking about. The answer is a very nice and healthy Shivan Panam LaTorah. Right. Shivan Panam LaTorah. There's a million ways to look at it. But that's what the Torah wants from you. Because I can't force feed you what I think the Torah means. If it doesn't make sense to you, what are the chances that I could put it over to the Claire? I'm going to talk to 20 boys in this year, and they're going to say, this is what I learned, this is what I learned. And you're rigid in your thought process because that's what you were told. But if I force feed it to you and then you have a problem and I tell you that's the only way you could look at it, if you have a problem with it, you have all these people that say, the Torah is so off base because it can't be, this can't be, or that can't be, and therefore this is the way it is. And I've, you know, especially in my life, when I talk to all these people through my life, the Torah is mistaken but that's not the only way to look at it. The best way to learn Torah and the best way is to accept it and learn is when it makes sense to you, then you could accept it. So just because you learn something you don't agree with it, maybe you're going to have, when I was in Chofetz Chaim, sitting in Beis Medrash, and everybody had on a rotation basis had to give shiur.
One option nearby is basement on Mott Street. Do you want that one?
That was funny. I'm going to turn it off. But that was Siri, right? Always. Anyhow, whatever it is, you're sitting in Beis Medrash, and that's the way the Rebbe is saying, I want to hear what your point of view is. Because you never know. And he would ask you, then he would, when things weren't going well, he would ask, he'd throw out a question, well, then I don't understand because this is. And somebody would say, well, wow, who asked that question? And he would say, I'm not telling. I'm not going to tell you. He says, he explained it at one point, says, if I tell you that Rabbi Kiva Eger asked this question, and the end result was, and so what does Rabbi Kiva Eger answer? He says, I don't know. He says, Mitzarachian. Doesn't have an answer. So you're going to shut down. And you're not going to even attempt to try to figure it out. Who said you can't? Maybe you will. There's no reason that you can't. Yehuda is going through all these recriminations and starting to say, I had the opportunity. Reuven, we focus on that he lost the opportunity, but Reuven never really recovered. Because he struck out. He again and again because he channeled anger. Yehuda was thinking about it. And so Vayered Yehuda Mei Esechav. He needed time to think. He needed time to mull over his experiences. What happened with his sons? Vayomas Erva Onan, right? He lost two sons. So what happened to Tamar? And she was waiting for Shelah to grow up. So the Ababinel makes a very interesting point over here. He says he can't accept the fact that he brought up two children, that Vayimiseu Hashem, Vayasu Esarabi, and Hashem, and they died. You have to reflect on that, and that's a very bitter pill to swallow. And he's not ready to accept. And he's thinking to myself, you know what? I think this is Tamar is so beautiful. She corrupted my sons. And if she's going to hang around the house until Shelah grows up, Shayla's got no chance. I want alone time with my son Shelah because that's the only way I could save him. He's trying to blame Tamar for the whole situation, and he says to Tamar, I need you to get out of my house. I want you out of here, because if you're around when Shayla's here, he's going to have such a taiva for you that it's going to ruin him too, because that's what happened till now. He can't accept. So when the end of the story is, Vayomer Tzadkami Meni, it's not that she was the way it is. Vayomer Tzadkami Meni, he comes to the realization, it's not the fault of Tamar, because her intentions were pure. Maybe she went about it wrong. And the fact that a lot of people go ahead and use the Maisa of Tamar as a raya for Yibam, the Abarbanel says, no chance. Obviously, this is not Yibam. This had nothing to do with Yibam. Why? The end of the story tells you it had nothing to do with Yibam, because it says, V'lo Yosef Oda Data. What happened after he found out? Did they stay together and be, you know, you want to say before Matan Torah? No. He realized he blew it. He realized he made a terrible mistake. It never should have happened. He made a mistake, and actually the Barbanel says what, the Malbim also says, what was Yehuda doing when it says, Vayered Yudov Me'esechav, what happened over here? It says, he had just, Vayal Zosono, he just like, you know, the cowboys come to, literally, the cowboys come to town after they bring in the herd, they made all the money, and now they're coming to town for a good night. With all the money out of their pocket, and they need money to burn. Tell this to yeshiva kids, right? And so, he sowed his wild oats one night. He was looking for trouble. But he was downtrodden. He was dejected, depressed. And all of this, I know, it's a very hard bill to, that's the way he presents the case. It's very interesting, though, don't you think? If you think about it from a psychologist's point of view, that this is, but you're thinking about people, and that's why the Torah interjects. Over here is that Yehuda is going through this growth process, and he realizes that he missed an opportunity. Same as we say Reuven missed the growth opportunity, Yehuda missed a tremendous growth opportunity, but he realizes it. And so later on, it's Anochi Erevenu Miyadit Vakshenu Vayometzot Kami Meni. He's starting to rise from the doldrums and reach this point that he has. Yaakov recognizes this. Go ahead.
It's something I don't understand.
Good.
With Er and Onan, she was very beautiful. So why didn't they have a taiva for her? I don't understand why.
Why didn't they? Who have a taiva for her?
They did not have, they didn't want to have relations.
What is the, who didn't want to have?
Er and Onan.
Who said that they didn't want to have relations with Tamar?
That's why they were punished.
But we don't, they didn't have maybe for the right reasons.
Well, what? Oh, they didn't want to.
That's not the, they had a time for her. But you know the people, the higher you are, the harder you fall. I mean, they you expect more of people. These were Yehuda's sons. Why wouldn't you think Yehuda's sons were?
Second one did not want it because he knew it was not going to be his child after his name.
Oh, exactly, right? Vayiki lolo yeazora. So that's. But the idea is, so all he wanted was a relationship, without thinking about it. So, you know, you think further. It's only, by the way, it's only the first son that is called after your brother. Successive children, child number two, number three, number four, if you're married a while, are going to be your children. It's only the first one that's the child of, you know, of your brother's child. But anyhow, that's the sideline. But that's the reality. So he's coming up, and he's rising to the occasion over here. And now Yaakov is saying, Yehuda, you are the one who came. Yes, Yehuda Sholach Kazos Lefonav Goshna. Yaakov is realizing over here that he put his eggs in the wrong basket to a point that Yosef, is also being used as a tool from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to affect the Yerida to Mitzrayim. But it's Yehuda who is now, his Ruach HaKodesh is telling him this much, that it's Yehuda that will be the leaders of the brother. Yehuda Ato Yaduch HaKecha. You're the one who comes. The Baal HaTorah makes an interesting point right at the beginning, and I don't know that I... it says the word Vayechi. We always know it says, what was the correlation of Ben Shvayesre Shana Hayoro Es Hechav Batzon, the first 17 formative years of Yosef's life. He was brought up by his father, and now just juxtaposing with the 17 years, the last 17 years of Yaakov's life. So the first 17 years, he supported him. And the last 7 years, the tables were turned and Yosef supported his father. So he says that 17 and 17 is 34. And Vayechi is Bigmatria 34. So that's the Baal HaTorah right at the beginning. So he says it's 34, it's 34. But what he doesn't say here is, so what you're trying to tell me, that sort of negates the whole issue of one of the things that I mentioned yesterday, was when the parasha begins, Vayechi Yaakov b'Eretz Mitzrayim, Shva Yisrael Shana, it says, Vayikruvu Yemei Yisrael Lamus. You're enjoying it too much here, so I see you're making too good of a life in enjoying yourself. And that's not good. But the point is, so it's time to go. The problem is over here is, it's making it sound like that Yaakov had a right to Vayechi, is just telling you that those same 17 years, Yaakov was putting it on a par, is giving you the impression that it's on a par. But what I wanted to suggest also at this point in time is, just because we're in Golus as well, doesn't mean we can't make a life and live that depressed life. In other words, we should want the Gula Shalema, we should want Mashiach to come, certainly. But nevertheless, it doesn't mean we can't make the best of a bad situation while we're here. And do and learn and try to make your life into as if on some level that you're not in Golus. Don't limit yourself to say, well, you know, when like the people who left Europe, they came to the Taif and the Medina, they came to America and they left it all behind. A lot of people who left, you know, the shtetl, they wanted to leave their Yiddishkeit behind. There's no excuse. I mean, maybe there is some excuse or reasons, but nevertheless, there are people you can affect a change by standing tall and doing so. Vayechi Yaakov b'Eretz Mitzrayim, Shva Yisrael Shana. He was in Egypt. The culture was totally different. He couldn't live with his family and be exactly the same Jew as he was in Eretz Yisrael, and it bothered him certainly, but he made the best of a bad situation. And that's the lesson for us as well. Just as an aside, we mentioned yesterday, I mean, today Shavuos Batam, I mean, it's Asar B'Teves, and you mentioned yesterday about Talmai, By the way, Ptolemy is also, just like we, Paro is a catch-all phrase for the leader, for the king, the czar. The word Ptolemy, Talmai, is also the same type of word. It's not one person, Ptolemy. Ptolemy, right, it's a title. So there were, in total, 5 Ptolemies. And so there's a machlokis about the actual time in history. There is a difference of opinion whether it was Ptolemy number 1 or Ptolemy number 2. Historically speaking, this one came right after Alexander the Great was, there's a lot, another book came out now about Alexander, about certain things that happened in his life, but he consolidated the kingdom, but when he died, he left a splintered nation, and he gave out to various people, and one of these was Talmai. He got a third of the kingdom, and was this Talmai number 1 or was this Talmai number 2? Seemingly, this is only this Ptolemy that had the occurrence, because there was a Ptolemy that was also in the story of Hanukkah, he was also a Ptolemy. What I didn't understand the time frame, though, was I was always under the impression it was Yehoshua ben Prachia was the from the Zugos in the time of the story of Hanukkah, but in this Sefer that's Shnos Dovr Dar, he puts it in the time of Shimon ben Shattach, which I didn't quite get, or somewhere in between, or lesser than that, because there are various stories told in terms of that. But that's what the time of Hanukkah is. That was just a sidelight, because I was just looking at things that I wrote down over here. In the brachas that he had, Vayar Menuchah Ki Tov, what Rabbi Alper makes an interesting point when it says Vayar Menuchah Ki Tov. What is Menuchah? What does it mean, Vayar Menuchah Ki Tov? We know sometimes, just to put in perspective the terminology, what is total rest when we think about really relaxation in terms of Menuchas HaNefesh. You could have, you know, there are different types of rest. We're going on, we go to Shir every day, and Rabbi Levine says at 10:45 or so, we're going to take a 5-minute break. So what is that 5 minutes? Is that a real rest period? Or that's just temporarily if you're in school and you have 2 minutes between classes, you have a lunch period, you have a recess. Sometimes at the end of every week, you have a relaxation period. You know, you have Shabbos, and maybe if you're in yeshiva, it's just that you get out of yeshiva early on Friday, and then you have Shabbos to recharge your battery, so to speak. Then comes along, you can have the Shalosh Regalim, when you're going to get a week off. Then you come to summer vacation, you have 2 months off. There is Vayar Menucha Ki Tov, it's total rest. It doesn't come at in the middle of the day when you take a break in the middle of the day. That's not called rest. Your mind is still working, and you're thinking, I have to go back in 20 minutes. The amount of relaxation time that you have affects your mindset how much. Vayar Menucha Ki Tov is telling you that real menucha is not physical rest. Vayar Menucha Ki Tov, just to put it in perspective, it's Menuchas HaNefesh, and you only get that if you're at peace with yourself. You have to be at peace with your thought process. And when somebody asked me in particular a couple of weeks ago, you know, you talk and you say all these things, but I remember thinking when I was in Beis Medrash and I was sitting and learning all day, and my father asked me after the first couple of months, and I came home. Yontif came out late the first year, and I came home after being a month in yeshiva. So how is it going? And I was very nervous about the whole prospect. I was thinking to myself, I used to learn till 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, and now I'm going to learn from, say, this starts at 9:30, and I had to be there till 11 o'clock at night with Seder, you know, even your own. I thought, I'm not going to be able to handle it. There's no way I'll handle it. But the end result was, the first couple of weeks, it was difficult. And then when I was talking about it to my father, I said there was a certain amount of peace that came over me, because that's all that was thinking on my mind. So many things that I used to bother me about this or that were totally, I was so engrossed, and I had no time for anything but this Seder, this Seder, this Seder. And as much as I had to work hard to keep it, there was a certain peace of mind. And now, at the same time, you know, we had all these discussions through our work years, and I still remember that, you want to be Meshabeach somebody for getting me to come here. I was at a wedding, and we were sitting there, and Yitzchak Roslin came over to me and said to me, Shmuel, guess what I'm doing? He said, you'll never guess. I said, what? He said, remember what we said? Remember what we promised? When it comes time, we're going to sit and learn. I'm sitting and learning. I immediately accused his son Joel of being his influence. And I said, so Joel got a hold of you and told you, because Joel is a, I could tell you his son is a Talmud Chacham. But nevertheless, I said, he said, no, it wasn't Joel. We said we're going to sit and learn, and I just thought this would be, it's time. And when I came home, I, you know, I did something at work that I said to Rivki, this is probably going to be the end for me, because I basically was whatever. Anyhow, and I kept waiting for the axe to fall, and it was a whole year was going by. I kept saying to my wife every Friday when I came home, this could be the last week, this could be the last week. I finally came home that time, Sukkot, and I said, this was the last week, you know. They asked me, you know, they wanted me to continue working, but in it, you know, I could work from the house. One boss was a crook, and he didn't want me seeing what was going on, which I saw. But anyhow, so that was the problem. So, but I said, it's time. And I just thought that, that was it. I didn't think it would come at that point in my life, but I realize now, and in some ways I'm even more busy, but there's a certain menucha I realize when I get up in the morning, when I go to bed at night, my mind is a continuity of thought process. I'm not concerned with other things. I never thought in my life, I remember my father was a Rebbe all his life, and I never thought in my mind, I used to, my father would tell me stories about how much he was into sports, and I accused him of never really being a real fan, because if he were, he'd still be a fan. And he said, you'll see. And the truth of the matter is, when my son sometimes thought to discuss with me certain things that went on the night before in a game, or that they went to the game and my grandchildren are trying to give me a blow-by-blow, I find it tedious and boring, and because it's interrupting my flow of thought. It's just that the more you get into it, it just, you know, the best thing to do is, by the way, you keep a safer on your night table, and before you close your eyes, it's just a suggestion. Open up any kind of a sefer and read a Mishnah or read a few psukim in the Chumash and close your eyes thinking about it. You'd be surprised with a clear head like that how much you're going to think of. Say the pasuk 5 times, 6 times. What does the pasuk say to me? What is it telling me? Forget what I learned in yeshiva. What does it say to me? And that gives you a certain clarity. And that is what Rabbi Alpert, in his introduction to the Sefer, he wrote. And he said, he asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he didn't understand so many things that bothered him, and he couldn't figure out an answer. And the Sfarim that he wrote are so unbelievable about the thought process, and all the Rishonim, the Akam, they have their own, you know, original thoughts, because they put things out of their mind, and they had, I mean, why else would, you know, why, how does Rashi's, if Rashi was the Pshat, then how does the Ramban get along and say, I mean, he doesn't say like the Alvar Benel says, but he gives you his own opinion. So that saying, he's saying that Rashi doesn't know what he's talking about. Basically, sometimes what they're saying, what? I understand. But basically, the thought process is, this is what the Chumash is saying to me. This is what I get from the Pasuk.
But what I like about the Ramban is he'll bring down, especially, he really goes after Rashi and the Eben Ezra.
The Eben Ezra was very...
Right. He takes them apart.
You haven't read much of Barbanel. You want to see people take somebody apart, because he mentions the Lashon that he uses is he spends pages telling you what other people say and telling you where it makes sense, but this is where they go wrong. And if you think that he's right, you got a problem. One time he uses the Lashon, Eino Elechote, if you think, he says about one of the Rishonim. You know, don't even begin to think that makes any sense. But that's their opinion. But that made them closer because they appreciate the Torah because this is what it means to them. That's what we want. What does it mean to you? If you like something you hear or if you don't like something you hear, don't say it can't be because my rabbi told me this and it can't be. The Torah is therefore went off the rails and I reject the Bible at this point in time. What does it say to you? I'm interested to know. That's what I was lucky enough to have some rebbeim says, what does it mean to you? And that's how you get closer to Yiddishkeit. If it means something to you, then great. And that's how you move on from there. So the interesting part is over here, Yaakov goes ahead and tells Yosef all the story about, with Dvar Samach Pela. And now he goes ahead and he says, about Meso Lai Rachel, Biol Kivraseris Levo Afrosa, you have to take me, you promised me you're going to take Yal Nosek Bereinim Mitzrayim, take me down to the Dvar Samach Pela, bury me there. And then at the end of the Parsha, he goes through the same thing again. When it says Vayesof Yaraglov Alamitov Vayeyosef Elamov, it's a very interesting point. He goes through and he tells the brothers the same thing that he told Yosef. So you would think on some level, number one, why is he telling all the brothers the same thing that he gave Yosef, a tzava, and now he gives the same tzava to the brothers? What's on Yaakov's mind over here? The thought process is, Yaakov is possibly thinking, I just read it before we started the shiur today, that he's thinking that maybe, why did he make Yosef promise, and you could tell Paro, Avicha Tzivah Lefnei Moso Lemar, so that Paro maybe will give him license to leave the country and bring up and take his father. But Yaakov is hedging his bets, and he's saying maybe Paro won't let Yosef leave anyhow. I don't know. So he's going through the motions of all the other are living in Goshen. They're living far. And maybe they'll be able, at this point in time, they'll be able to travel. At least, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, they'll be able to take me. So I told Yosef, but I want to tell my other brothers the same thing. I also want to tell them the background of the Ma'ariv Samach Pela in case we end up with a problem that you should know that it's my plot. There's another problem. And that he's saying over there, Asher kono me'eis Ephron achiti, the end of the pasuk. Why does it say lachuzas kover? Because when Avraham buys the Ma'ariv Samach Pela from Ephron, what happened? He bought a huge tract of land. The Ma'ariv Samach Pela is a very small piece of property. The Abravanel points out at that point in the Chayei Sarah at the beginning, that what Ephron is saying to Avraham is a very interesting point. He's saying, you want to use this piece of property as a burial site. You only want a small piece of land. This is a place where we plant. He's trying to pump up the value of the land by saying, I get X amount of crops, I have the ability to make this land. And now I'm going to give you a small piece of land to build a cemetery over here, who's going to want to build next to a cemetery? There's a whole area that I'll not be able to sell at this point. It's so far removed from, so I have to give you want to buy 1 acre, you're going to have to buy 10 acres of land, because I'm not going to be able, we know what happened with the Mariam Towers on Ocean Parkway when they had the Washington Cemetery over there. The guy that built the apartment building over there, he committed suicide because he couldn't rent the property over there. He put up a beautiful building and nobody wanted to live in the building, especially the apartments that were facing the cemetery. He couldn't rent them. And he committed suicide. That's the history of that building. Because who wanted to look down, open your window and look down at gravestones? So he's saying the same thing. I have to sell you more property. So he's not just saying, in case they tell you that, you know, I sold him the property, but, you know, you have to use it for parkland, you have to use it for planting crops, things like that. So, Asher Kono La'achuzas Kover, I told him right from the get-go, Avram is giving a total and complete history here. I bought it from him legally, and not only that, but it was bought for the express purpose of using the land as burial site. Don't let him give you a story that's not what it was intended for, because I'll tell you now who's there. It's Avraham and Yitzhak are there, Yitzhak and Rivka are there, and now Leah is buried there. He's trying to forestall any complications that might arise at a later date. He's just dotting his I's, crossing his T's, and giving the brothers. He tells it to Yosef, and he tells it. Now, the interesting thing is over here, when it says, Vayesof Raglov El Amito, we have this concept, and we say that Yaakov Avinu Lomes says very, you know, the Vayiru Echov Kimes Avihem, Yosef saw that his father died. It says it in more than one place, that he died. And what does it mean? And so also you mean to tell me that Avraham, Yaakov was so much greater, Avraham dies? We're trying to, when we say Yaakov Lomes, it's giving us the impression that, you know, he was greater than Avraham and Yitzhak on some level. Of course, we know Avraham died, Yitzhak was Nifta, so Yaakov Avinu Lomes. Very interestingly enough, if you look at the Pasuk, he says on a very simple level, what gives rise to the whole concept? In other words, why do we even begin to think? Because by Avraham and Yitzhak, it says, what does it say by Yaakov? It doesn't say the word Vayomos. In other words, the Torah, they say, they see that he died. But the Chumash doesn't say it in terms of that language. It says Vayigva Vayasof Raglov Elamita. But what does it really mean? What are we trying to say? Avraham was the progenitor of the religion, certainly, and Yitzhak carried the torch. But the 12 Shvatim arose, B'nai Yisrael arose from Yaakov. And when now they were in Mitzrayim, it would easily be Avraham lived and died in Eretz Yisrael. He spent time away, certainly many years of his life he wasn't there. Yitzhak lived his whole life in Eretz Yisrael, and that the foundation is beginning to grow, but it has some rotten roots of Esav and Yishmael. But Yaakov sees that these are the Shiftei Kah, the roots are strong now, and he sees, as we say, that he saw the Shvatim were all Shomer Torah mitzvos at this point in their life. It wasn't so much that Yaakov Lomes, but people live through their children. So Yaakov Lomes means the children carried on the tradition, they carried on the legacy that the Avos left them. And that is Yaakov Lomes. You might think that here he is living the final 17 years of his life and they assimilated and, you know, that was the end of the Jewish people. They went down to Mitzrayim, they're going to be there. The Lashon of Yaakov Lomes meant, very simply, that B'nai Yisrael will continue to be a nation. Yaakov Lomes, they continue the tradition. The child is, I see, that he's continuing in his father's footsteps. He may have some missteps initially, but as we see, there was a Yetzias Mitzrayim, Yaakov Lomes. Because if he did, we wouldn't be here today. And that's what it means by Yaakov Mace. We know it says in the Chumash, very simple, you can't get away from it. He was buried. The interesting thing that the Abarbanel makes a point of grammar over here, and we have words. One thing that he says, when they bury Yaakov, and it says, Vayivku Mitzrayim Shivim Yom, Vayivku was here. When it says, Vayimlu lo arboim yom, kichen yimlu yimei hachanutim, Vayivku oso Mitzrayim Shivim Yom. He says, does that mean the entire Egyptian nation mourned for 70 days? No. He says, no. There's a letter missing, and he says, Vayivku, in other words, they initially, the first 30 days, there was, you know, basically, they had a moment or a month of mourning for the people because he brought an end to the, you know, the Nile began to rise up as soon as Yaakov came down. The years of famine ended when Yaakov came down. But when it says Vayivku Oso, it's Vayivku Oso is not talking about the Mitzrayim. It's talking about his family. When it says Oso Bimitzrayim Shivim Yom, that they, Yaakov's family, mourned him for 70 days. That's what he says, the actual, what it means. And he gives other examples to show that that's how you could look at the phraseology, and that's what it means. He said there's a bays missing over here, and it should be Vayivku, not that it's missing, but the inference is, read it like that. Vayivku, so the Egyptians mourned for X amount of time, and Bnei Yisrael, his family, the Shvatim and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren, they mourned him Shivim Yom. They mourned him for 70 days because then the Chumash tells us when they carried his Aron to the Maris HaMachpelah, they, at that point in time, they also, Vayispedu Sham, his paid Godol, you know, Kaved Miot, they mourned him at that point. So why would it say it then? It would be over. Because this mourning period was for the family who mourned him at this point in time. We want to take a break now for a little bit, or we want to stop, I don't know. There are a lot of halachas that have to do with the parsha, of course, and we could do that as well. I probably have other things that I wrote down last night about 1 o'clock in the morning, I don't know.